your advisement. We'll call our next case, United States versus, and I hope I'm saying the family's name right, Cardassi.
You want to join us up here?
Could you raise your voice a little bit,
please? Yes. When the government sues to enforce a federal tax lien on property, the presumption is that the property will be sold. A district court's discretion to say no without preventing sale is extremely limited. And where a district court chooses to exercise that discretion to thread that needle based on unsound fact finding, it abuses that discretion as a matter of law.
So let me ask you this question. I want to make sure I sort of understand the landscape. If this was a property that the, is it Cardassi or what? What is it?
How do you say
Cardassi?
Cardassi,
Your Honor.
Cardassi?
Yes. Okay. Cardassi. So, thank you. All right. So, if the Cardassis bought the property in 78 and we're dealing with the statute in 1988 and we're dealing with King and Newman as the sort of common law prior to that, is a fundamental issue that this should be treated as a tenancy in common and not tenancy by the entirety?
At what point are you suggesting that it would be treated as a tenancy in common?
Well, if the purchase preceded the application of the 1988 statute, doesn't that mean that it's not treated as a tenancy by the entirety, or do I have that all wrong?
It is treated as a tenancy by the entirety. The remedy that in attaching New Jersey state law creditor, separate from the United States, would have under New Jersey law, under King and Newman, would be to displace the debtor's house and enter into effectively a tenancy in common with the non-debtor's house. And the remedies available to a creditor in that situation under New Jersey law are twofold. That creditor could either seek partition of the property. And neither King nor Newman ordered that relief, but both cases indicated that the relief was available. The alternative approach, which is in evidence in Newman and in the Frieda case subsequently, is to compel the non-liable spouse to pay the fair rental value of the debtor spouse's interest in the property to the attaching creditor, effectively as a the price you pay for avoiding ouster from the property that you're now holding in common with the creditor. That's not the situation that we have here. Mm-hmm. That is, and there's a lot of discussion in the briefs about what would happen if this were a case where there was simply a New Jersey state law creditor and the lien was a judgment lien or some other kind of claim on property under state law. This is a federal tax lien.
Exactly. And one of the things that the judge wrote into the opinion, I thought, was, in essence, look, I'm given this rental alternative remedy, but if they don't pay, if they're not current, you come back, you can sell the thing. Now, am I correct in understanding that they haven't done the things they're supposed to be doing? Then, you know, the question that immediately hit me, is it Aveda? Is why are you here arguing over the legal principles when in the district court you have an immediate remedy that takes you right to what you want because the district court said, in essence, come back to me if they're not doing what they're supposed to do and you can sell the house.
In fact, Your Honor, that's not what the district court said. It did deny the foreclosure claim ostensibly without prejudice, but there were several notices of default that were filed on the district court docket after they immediately and then complied with the rental order. There was no summary proceeding authorized to enforce the lien. The government would effectively
did
have
you,
to reboot the
did you go back to the
did
district court and ask for relief?
To go back to the district court and start over, Your Honor.
What?
To replead and re-argue the entire picture.
It's not when you say you'd had to reboot. You're saying that you didn't think it was within your power to go back and say, Your Honor, based on the things the court itself indicated in the opinion, we want to to have a relook at foreclosure. In other words, even if it meant you had to file another complaint with the institute, and I'm not sure you would have, something you could have approached the district about and asked the district court about, why isn't that, given the court's statement that it was without prejudice and what I read to be a pretty strong indication that if they failed in their obligations, you were going to have opportunity. Why didn't you go back? I don't get that.
Well, there are several reasons. This is not the first case where a New Jersey District Court has attempted to circumvent the rights of the governor under Section 7403 by correcting a state law remedy instead. 7403 is not a backup plan for the government. It's not if they treat you as a state law creditor and that remedy doesn't work for you, then you can come back and have your rights under federal law. For the United States of America, federal tax lien is enforceable primarily under the federal tax code.
So the answer is you kind of think the District of New Jersey is off the reservation here and you want to get them back in.
Primarily, Your Honor, because of the valuation question. And that's not something that could be resolved by going back and seeking a sale of the house.
Let me ask you about the valuation question. You believe that there should have been a 50-50 determination regarding valuation, correct?
Thank you, Your Honor, because the precedent is court system.
Well, okay, in Popke. But let's look at the Rogers test. Is it your position that determination of how the proceeds would be split, if you will, that is necessary as part of the Rogers consideration of the Rogers factors?
The Rogers factors ask the court to consider the character and value of the liable and non-liable interest in property.
Of the possessory and fee interests.
Not simply that. Future interests are also valued under that.
Where in Rogers does it say that? It says the present possessory interest or fee interest.
Page 711, where Rogers says the fourth factor is the relative character and value of the non-liable and liable interest held in the property, and courts reading that have not limited that to the possessory fee interest.
All right, so your view is the court does have to do a valuation?
No, Your Honor. Our view is that the court should consider all of the sticks in the bundle when deciding who has which rights in property that is subject to sale under 7403.
And it's your view that survivor interest, life estate, those type of interests, life expectancy, those things need to be considered or not? Your position is intended by the entirety is strictly 50-50.
But not inconsistent outcomes. You are considering the survivorship interests of the tenants by the entirety when you reach a 50-50 value.
How?
Not really.
How so? If you've just, if the court says, and it does say in Rogers, you need to take into account actuarial reality, how can you square that with saying it's 50-50? Because 50-50 is saying, who cares what actual reality is? Actuarial reality is irrelevant. It's 50-50.
It is not irrelevant, Your Honor, but that is the result that is reached when you account for, particularly on these facts, the equivalent life expectancies.
Then you've just answered the question, right? You do have to take account of life expectancy. You can't just default to 50-50 because you could have Hugh Hefner and bunny number 87 with a 65-year gap and a real serious difference in actuarial expectancy, right?
We would not urge the court to look at their actuarial life expectancies in those circumstances. We would instead urge the court to look at the common law treatment of that tenancy on dissolution.
If the court says in Rogers, account for actuarial reality, your position is account for it unless there's a big gap and then ignore it?
No, Your Honor. That is not our position. Let me make clear first that in Rogers, you were looking at Texas Homestead, which is actually a life estate. There is a measuring life and there is no future interest. So the length of the measuring life matters when you are evaluating that type of estate.
It matters with life estates too, right?
It matters with life estates too. It does not matter with tenancy by the entirety because the disposition of the rights of the spouses in a tenancy by the entirety have already been resolved at common law and they did not depend on the common law.
So the rights of survivorship don't matter?
The rights of survivorship do not matter, and I refer this court to the Sixth Circuit reasoning in the Barr case, which said that if life expectancy in the common law calculation of a 50-50 distribution upon contested divorce, where you might have a vast age disparity among the co-tenants by the entirety who are now severing that tenancy, the common law would account for that. And the distribution of the proceeds of the sale of that tenancy would reflect that there was some legal compensable interest correlated to the life expectancy of the co-tenants. You don't see that in common law, in New Jersey or in anywhere else.
How about explain to me why in the, and I hope I'm saying this case name right, it's the Pletz case out of the Ninth Circuit. In that case, if I understand, that's what you cite in your reply brief, the Ninth Circuit, at the government's urging, at the urging of the IRS, took the position that you do have to take account of the life expectancies. And you should use a joint actuarial table to figure those things out. If I misunderstood the case, or has the government changed its mind, or what's going on?
What has happened since Pletz is that the Supreme Court has decided Kraft. And what you see in Pletz is similar to what you saw in the Jones case in the District of New Jersey. Before Kraft made clear that the federal tax rate attached to the tenancy by the entirety, the government basically had recourse to various other remedies to attempt to assert its lien claims. It could not simply stand forward and say, we have a lien on this property.
What does that have to do with the common law? What does that have to do? I mean, a moment ago you were saying you don't value the life estates because the common law doesn't value the life estates under these circumstances. That has nothing to do with whether Kraft clarified that you could attach directly based on a federal lien, does it?
My reflection also is that Pletz was a bankruptcy case. It was not a Section 7403 case, so you're not...
Doesn't matter.
No, it does matter, Your Honor, because you're not deciding the tenancy by the entirety.
You were valuing the interests. What doesn't matter whether the context is bankruptcy or it's a dissolution or it's a forced sale. The question is the value of the interest that the property holders have. And that doesn't make any difference. In theory, it shouldn't, should it? Whether that regime that you're operating under while you're making the valuation is bankruptcy or some other umbrella of the law, right?
It does, because what you are valuing is what someone's going to take away from the process, not what they...
Precisely.
And in Pletz, where you're determining the extent of a secured claim on property in a bankruptcy estate, there is the question before the court was different than how do you, what is the extent of compensation, or what is the extent of the tax impact to property held in its tenant. Also, because you did not have the guidance of Kraft at that point, and
Kraft says nothing about valuing property, right? It just says nothing about that.
That's right.
Okay.
But as the taxpayers cite in their brief, the Rogers dictum on valuation was something that the Supreme Court was thinking about in Kraft. And they were saying, well, is it always going to be 50-50, or is there going to be an actuarial valuation? And the government was at best non-committal on that. And they said, well, in Rogers, there was an actuarial valuation. And we presented to the court the reason why Rogers is distinguishable on those grounds. Pletz, we would submit, is distinguishable because you are not dealing with a context where the common law would have liquidated tenancy and distributed the proceeds.
We're just talking about... I understand the context is different, but I still haven't, and maybe it's because there isn't a good answer to it, I still haven't fathomed your answer about why valuation would be different. Valuation is valuation. You come in, you assess what the interests of the parties are, and you put a value on it, hopefully with some level of expertise and rationality. And I'm still not understanding. If you've got a rationale, I'd like to hear it, why the position the government actually advocated in Pletz or Pelt, heard it.
I believe it's Pletz.
Pletz should come to a different valuation than it should here. You know, it's not Kraft, because Kraft says nothing about valuation. It's not bankruptcy, because that doesn't make values different. I don't get it. I just don't get it yet.
I would respectfully distinguish, Your Honor, with your second statement of saying that the value in bankruptcy is potentially different from the number that you're reaching in a 7403 action, because you're not disrupting the tenants. You're merely determining the extent of a secured claim.
Maybe we're just talking past each other. What you're saying is you valued a different thing, but it's still about valuation. The method of valuation is what I'm talking about. And you came up with a method of valuation which seemed fair and sensible in Platts. You said, use a joint actuarial table. I take it that your argument there was, it's got a thing baked into it. That actuarial table has the math in it. It'll help you understand what the values are. Use that. That's a safe, fair approach. Here you're saying, don't do that. 50-50. Game up.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the actuarial table, even in Platts, is only a best approximation with respect to any given image. The government does not submit actuarial tables as mathematically precise for triangulating the life expectancy or a valuable life expectancy of any given individual because that information is not baked into the table. And we have explained that in greater detail in our brief. What you're evaluating in a Section 74(3) case is informed by how an estate is distributed upon dissolution of common law. What you're valuing in bankruptcy is not.
Okay.
And the 50-50 comes from the common law, and the circuit has already adopted it.
Well, we adopted it in the context where property was sold, right? I mean, you were valuing cash. You were not evaluating going forward. This doesn't work if we're talking over each other. And so let me try to finish the question. I understand Popke to be saying this is a pile of cash, 50-50. We're not talking about a pile of cash. We're talking about a house, and we're talking about future interests in that property, right? Aren't those very different things?
They are not under this analysis because the tenancy by the entirety was preserved in the sale proceeds of the Popke's residence. There are rights of survivorship, and there are rights to block liquidation, I believe it was cash, but if it were, for example, a security or some other personal thing, those rights that are accorded to them by the common law and the tenancy by the entirety survive into the personal thing. It's not limited to property or even residential property. Any property by the entirety is subject to all of the sticks in the bundle. And you're looking at the value of all of those sticks when you're reaching a valuation of common law. And the common law has consistently said that when you are singleness, the distribution is 50-50 because those rights are equal regardless of the life expectancy and regardless of how you determine the life expectancies of those tenants.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you. Mr. Monzo. The answer to that is yes, but if you get up and you start saying something new that's not actually a rebuttal to her rebuttal, then I just need to sit down. All right? Because we're not, you know, you can have a true rebuttal if you want it, but you can't have a chance to just talk about other stuff. So if that's how you want it, it's okay by me.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If the government is true to see 15
minutes. That should show as 2 minutes off this clock now.
Your Honor, the government is ignoring one of the most important steps in the bundle when it comes to valuing the property of a spouse in a tenancy by the entirety situation, and that is the life estate. It's not just a right of survivorship, but it's a right of survivorship with a right of possession for the remainder of the life of each spouse.
Given that that's true, how can you justify the district court's accounting for the value of the life estate for Mrs. Cardassi, but then saying we're not taking account of the value of the same thing that inheres in Mr. Cardassi?
I think Judge Mandel did explain his position on that, Your Honor, and he...
I'm asking for you to justify... You'd explain how it can be fair, equitable, reasonable in evaluation to say, I'm paying attention to one spouse's life estate, I'm not paying attention to the others.
In this case, Your Honor, the only interest that the government needs to compensate for is Mrs. Cardassi.
But they're equivalent. The interests are equivalent, are they not?
They are equivalent. If they were seizing Mrs. Cardassi's interest, it would be that Mr. Cardassi's interest would be valued the same way that Judge Samantha valued Mrs. Cardassi's interest.
So it's 86%. 14% the other way if they were going after Mrs. Cardassi? It's a sort of a heads I win, tails you lose thing for the government?
Well, Your Honor, in Rogers, I think Justice Brennan recognized that there could be a disparity. entirety, and even said in that decision that when you add up the values separately, they could significantly exceed 100%, or they could be significantly less than 100%.
I guess the question is, why is the life tenancy or the life estate calculated in Mrs. Cardassi's favor, yet not offset by an separate but equal calculation of Mr. Cardassi?
Mrs. Cardassi is the person whose property is being taken by reason of for sale, and that was...
Well, both their properties are being taken by the for sale, right? I mean, she's not uniquely situated there. It's a joint property, and it's being taken if it's taken by a for sale. So that's the difficulty that we're kind of talking around. We're trying to get you to grapple with, if you can come up with one, a reason in the law why the district court say, yeah, I'm counting your life estate, Mrs. Cardassi, but I'm not counting yours, Mr. Cardassi. What in the law can you point to that says that's okay? What case, what statute, what anything can you point to that says it's okay?
Rogers, Ron. Rogers said that.
Rogers does not say that. I've read that case, and it certainly doesn't say that. Go ahead, though. Take me to the language you think says that.
Well, Justice Brennan and Rogers said, first he said that we must read the statute.
We have it in front of us. You can tell us where you're reading from.
First, Justice Brennan says on page 677, we must read the statute to contemplate not merely the sale of the delinquent taxpayer's interest, but the sale of the entire property, if the owner of the United States has a claim of interest in it, and the recognition of third-party interest through a mechanism of judicial valuation.
677
is the syllabus.
It's not the opinion.
But even if that were the case, that doesn't, I mean, even if you were reading from the opinion and not the syllabus, that doesn't say that you can ignore the rights of one of the co-tenants as you're evaluating the value of the interests of the parties. It just seems to me that maybe there's something to that, and we should be asking you something different.
Let me ask a question. The first factor, the first Rogers factor, Judge Simandl used the 8614 numbers in considering the first factor. I read the first factor differently. I read the first factor as saying, you look, and this is all, the Rogers test has to do with the interests of third parties. It's not simply husband and wife. It can be, you know, six people own a piece of property. And the first factor says, you look at that, the interest of the one, and you say, would partial sale prejudicial? Or in terms of, is that possible? Here, it seems to me, partial sale would be prejudicial because nobody's going to buy Mr. Cardassi's half interest in this property and live with Mrs. Cardassi. It's just not happening. Whereas in another situation where there's six people who own a piece of property and they're all investors and one of them delinquent, well, you know, somebody may buy a 1/6 interest in that piece of real property, you know, as an investment. Isn't that what the first factor is about? How is it that a valuation of 8614 has anything to do with the first factor?
Well, mainly, Your Honor, because a partial interest would yield a much lower percentage of the property. So that is a factor that would not yield a great result and a fair result on a sale. And compared to the tax liability, it wasn't relevant. I think the fourth factor was really where Justice Simandl articulated the 86-14 split when he looked at the relative values of the interest of each
one. Okay, but it makes a huge difference. You've got four factors. If you're kind of rigging two of them by versus the valuation, it's going to impact, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, and I still go back to Rogers.
But it really has to do with the ability to sell, even when the partial interest would be worth less sold separately than sold as part of the entire property. That doesn't mean you look at the valuation. That means You know, what's a willing buyer going to pay? Isn't that the answer?
Where a partial interest, Your Honor?
Yeah. What's a willing buyer going to pay? That has nothing to do with the 8614, does it?
But it has to do with the fourth factor.
No. I'm talking about first factor. The willing buyer is going to pay for somebody's interest. Has nothing to do with how you split up the proceeds, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, thank you. That's all I want.
Yeah.
So don't we have to tell Judge Samuel at least that he needs to go back and redo Rogers on that basis alone, if nothing else?
Well, I think what you're saying is, what is a partial interest worth, and will the sale of a partial interest as opposed to the entire interest be the best result for everybody involved? And he concluded no, based on the fact that the sale of a partial interest may not.
Based on what you just acknowledged was an erroneous application, right? Because the first factor is is the government prejudiced by trying to sell a partial interest? It isn't at all about valuing the property and dividing it if you were selling it all together. That's a different factor, different analysis, but he inserted that into the first factor, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So since the remedy that was ultimately given was an exercise of equitable discretion, how could we get behind that and uphold it? Maybe there's a way, but you need to explain how, when the legal analysis that led him to that involved, we've identified one which you agree with, a legal error, that is, he applied factor one in a way that just isn't factor one.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think he applied factor one to make a determination that the sale of a partial interest would not yield a significant sum to the government. Who is going to buy a property subject to the right of survivorship of Mrs. Cardese?
Exactly.
Plus, as this court said in Avila,
no one.
Her right of possession.
Yeah,
no
that's
one.
True. He did say that. And then under factor one, he went on to do evaluation of the property and as if it were division of the property, the sale and division of the property, which is erroneous, we've all agreed. I guess what I'm asking is, in exercising equity, it's got to be based on an appropriate legal foundation. If he missteps, can we still say, well, it was a misstep, but it was a harmless misstep, and we think he would exercise his equitable discretion the same way anyway, so it's all good. Can we do that, or do we have to send it back?
I'm not acknowledging it was legal error. I thought he made the right analysis in the first factor. The valuation really was the fourth factor, where he looked at the relative interests of the parties, and he valued, as this court instructed in Avila, that it needs to be based on the survivorship right plus the possessory interest. The example in Rogers came to almost the same conclusion in terms of the percentage amount.
Why don't you take on the argument from the government, if you would, that we're bound here to make a 50-50 split. Popke tells us we have to do it, and that's what New Jersey common law tells us we have to do too. You just made a New Jersey common law argument. What's your response?
I disagree, Your Honor.
I thought you would, but
well, I have the Supreme Court to support that. Frieda and Newman, pre-1988 statute, said that a sale of the property is subject to the possessory rights and survivorship rights of the non-debtor spouse under common law. And that was acknowledged by this court in Avila, on a government potential. And it was a hypothetical, so it's dictated in the case. But they said if the government were to force a sale of property, the sale would take place and it would be subject to the survivorship rights and the right of possession of the non-debtor spouse.
But here maybe we don't need to decide it so much because it ends up being 50-50 anyway. Because based upon the survivorship, based upon the actuarial tables, each of them has an equal chance of surviving, correct?
But they also collect the state and the entire property.
Yeah, they each both do.
Each equally.
But if I may, Your Honor, just call your attention to the example of Rogers, which came to a percentage of 82%. For a spouse at age 70.
Okay.
And it applied the Arkansas actuarial tables, and for the government to argue that it's just an approximation, they do it all the time. Their tables are in section 2031 of the regulations, which they value partial interest, life estates. They use these tables.
Nobody's disagreeing with the premise here for purposes of questioning you. actuarial tables can be consulted. You keep going back to what the district court did, which is to say it's okay to look at her life estate, but not his. And that's what's puzzling, at least to me.
The tables that were used.
Yeah.
Because the government needs to compensate Mrs. Cardassi for her deprivation of a property right. And that was that's what the case is about. And that's what Rogers said. And Rogers went to great lengths to say that in order to avoid a takings, we need to conduct a valuation.
Sure.
Not 50-50. We need to value the rights of the non-debtor spouse.
So if you value the rights of the non-debtor spouse, and the non-debtor spouse has the same survivorship rights, the same life estate rights, the same possessor rights, and the same actuarial life expectancy. If all those things are the same, does it just math and logic tell you we're at 50-50?
No.
Okay.
And I say that only because that's what the Supreme Court of Rogers said. It could be worth significantly more when you add the parts together. And the government has acknowledged that in Reverend Williams as well.
All right. Well, we'll have you back maybe on rebuttal, depending on what they say in rebuttal. We'll find out.
Stay tuned.
Ms. Zavetta.
Note that we didn't actually reach the cross-appeal question, so I'm uncertain what the Sir Rebuttal would address. But
maybe nothing if you don't start raising it.
Rogers provides that an interest sold separately when it's part of a community of interest in property may, when you add all of those up, total more than 100%. In some way, pre-action rights are not sold separately. This is a distinction also in a case like Plutz, where you are looking at the interest of one spouse in a backing. When you are liquidating an entire tenancy by the entire name of Section 7403, all of the rights are distinguished by the conveyance, and the purchaser gets clear title. That's why you have a constitutional question, and that's why the extent of the federal tax lien is important.
Assume for the sake of discussion that we thought actuarial data mattered, all right? And that we thought that Plutz made sense when it said, use a joint actuarial table. And we used that, or suggested to the district court it should use that. Does the district court have to do some calculation based on that of a present, of future values and then discount it to present values? Or is that kind of operation somehow, when you're talking about the percentages of the property value, somehow contained in the methodology of using the joint actuarial table in the first place? That was a terribly asked question. Did you follow that?
What I believe you're asking, Your Honor, is
I hope
if
you
use the correct actuarial tables, would the discounting happen automatically, or would there be additional effort that the court I am not an actuary. I believe the answer to that question is yes, but
it's baked in, right? Is it baked in?
I think that when you're looking at two measuring types, the tables definitely correlate for the statistical odds of one person predeceasing the other are determined differently than the statistical odds of one person living to a
sure. So that what you'd have to do, I guess, is the court would have to make some kind of valuation of life estates, survivorship rights, and then it may have to discount that to present value. But once it comes to an overall valuation, if it uses the joint actuarial table, all it does at that point, it's math. You take those tables and you figure out what the relative interests are and you multiply. Have I understood that right?
I believe that that's correct. And I believe in the bankruptcy context, that's what you see. When you are valuing in something that is not sold separately, to be valued separately.
But we don't really need to address the actuarial aspect in this case, do we?
That is correct. Because even if the actuarial tables were applied, it's an undisputed matter of record that the parties have equivalent life expectancies. So each of their life estates and each of their remainder interests were identical.
So how does the fourth factor come out?
In a tenancy by the entirety, it is basically a foregone conclusion. and we have suggested that, that Rogers loses a lot of its instructive value when you're looking at a joint estate with reciprocal life interests. Because the first Rogers factor, the prejudice to the government, is always going to be constant, and that's as Roger described, which is you cannot sell a marital interest in property. There is no market for that. The second Rogers factor, the legally recognized expectation of the non-liable spouse, the prejudice to
that will go in favor of the spouse somewhat, although under New Jersey law, it's not as strong as it is under other laws.
It seems perhaps nationwide, with respect to the federal creditor, no one has that expectation anymore. It is now a matter of law that a federal tax lien, uniquely in some jurisdictions, can attach to a tenancy by the entirety. Okay. In New Jersey, as Your Honor has noted, but even state law creditor.
All right.
And then the only Rogers factor that is instructive in a tenancy by the entirety is the prejudice to the non-liable creditor.
But that's supposed to be extreme or not standard prejudice. So wouldn't the drill be that we send it back to Judge Simandl saying do a do-over?
We don't feel that that's necessary. The factual record was fully developed. There was a multi-day trial. It is clear what the prejudice is.
So we would do the analysis in the first instance of the Court of Appeals?
The analysis has been done.
No, but it was done improperly.
The only factual error can be corrected by applying the precedent of this court.
We don't usually do that in the first instance. If we think the district court did something, balance some factors incorrectly, we usually send them back for a do-over because it is a balancing.
Is your position that no rational judge could come out and say that it's appropriate for there to be a rental arrangement instead of a forced sale? Because unless that's your position, if we agreed there was legal error, we'd have to send it back for a reweighing of equities, right?
If that's the approach that the court feels is necessary, we would suggest simply that no further factual development is necessary, and if the court is simply reapplying the law, an equitable determination does not come into play here for the reasons that we've explained, that the Rogers test doesn't have a view to the equities that try to incorporate state law remedies as less invasive alternatives to the rights of the federal
credit. Okay, we got you. Thanks very much. Nothing was said, Mr. Monzo, about your side of that, so we've got the arguments. We'll take it under advisement. Thank you, counsel, for your briefing and your argument today. We appreciate